10:03 a.m., Groundhog Day, February 2nd. I'm starting to talk a little bit early, just because I have, I think, a lot to talk about. I've got a lot to catch up on. And so I thought, since I've missed the last few days, I'd make this episode a little bit longer than normal. And yeah, I'm walking by the noisy highway. This is an almost solid 1 mile straight stretch from here to the other end. So we'll see how this works out. So the last time I talked to you, I was getting ready to go to Colorado Springs to go to the convention, Cosine. Cosine was a lot of fun. I got to spend some time with Charlie Strauss, with Connie Willis, and we had a lot of fun. That was a small con. There was about 20 authors there, maybe 25, and about 250 guests. So it was a 10-to-1 ratio, which is really quite good, actually. Now, the panels were fairly well attended. There were only, at most, 3 of them at a time. There were readings. I didn't get to do a reading. Perhaps next year. I do intend to go back next year. But the panels themselves were fairly well attended and, for the most part, relatively interesting. Even the ones, or especially the ones that I wasn't on. But I went to several of them, which, for those of you who know me in cons, know that that's not necessarily the way I spend my time at a con. So I'm not going to do a day-by-day rundown of it. It was a lot of fun. I really do need to drive down to Denver. I took books to a consignment shop there and then walked off without picking them up again. They sold 2. Yeah, I was worried about that. And while I'm glad that we sold the 2, honestly, it really wasn't worth the effort. I had a case of books with me that was 10 of each title. And I gave a couple away, sold a couple at the table. There was an autograph session that was quite interesting. They handle autographs differently. Rather than having autograph sessions spread out through the weekend, where everybody gets a half an hour at the table with perhaps a partner or two, everybody signed at the same hour. There was a cash bar and a raffle. And authors who were there were asked to donate a book or two to the raffle. The money goes to, I don't know if it goes to literacy. Frankly, I don't care where it goes. But I tossed a couple of books in. And what happens is that people buy raffle tickets through the weekend for a buck. And then during this signing period, this party, they call out the numbers for the raffle tickets. And everybody gets a pile of books. And then, of course, since all of the authors, or pretty much most of the authors, are already there, they just go around with their pile of books and get them all signed all at once. So I think the pile of books was 6 or 7 tall for everybody, I believe. It was quite an interesting pile for a buck. For those 2 people who won the raffle, it was quite a deal. For those of us who were sitting at the table, I got 2 signatures out of it, and a couple of people who would then stop by. I met some interesting people. I particularly met a lot of authors who were just starting out, who wanted to talk to me about starting out. And it was really interesting to talk with them, to see what they thought about writing and starting out as a new author. So I spent a fair amount of time talking to new authors, talking to authors who have gone about this idea of becoming an author in the social media age somewhat differently. One guy, and he's invited me back, there's another conference next month down there called Galaxy Fest. And he's invited me back to be on a panel about new media. Specifically about marketing, I believe, if I remember correctly. But he's really good, he's told me. He's really good at lining up signings and at getting people to come to signings and buy his books. Now, he sells in a month what I sell in a day. That's not to put down his sales. That's to give some perspective on where some of these people are who are doing a lot of hand selling of paperback books. One of the panels I was on was about the ebook marketplace, and there were a number of people in the audience who raised a lot of the old standard complaints. It's like, how are you going to read your book in 5 years when the device is no longer available, like floppy disks? And the reality of that is that as long as we have a representation of the book, as long as I have a digital version of the book that's not encumbered with DRM, I can make that book be any kind of book that I want. So maybe Kindle goes out of business, or Nook goes out of business, or Kobo goes out of business. I still have those files. I can still express the story in a new way. I can express the story in paper if I want. I can express the story in digital if I need. It's really, as long as I've got a backup copy, it's never going to go away. And likewise with books, as a reader, as long as I've got a backup copy, as long as I'm able to get my books in ways that make sense to me, it's never going to go away. Unlike paperback book, or if you have a house fire, it's gone. There's an old axiom about people who have a wandering lifestyle, who are more mobile than others. And for a while in my life, in my youth in particular, I was quite mobile. I made it a point not to own anything that I couldn't carry by myself, at least down 2 flights of stairs and out to a truck. It was one of the reasons I bought a waterbed. I could carry the pieces by myself, and the mattress didn't have to be, you know, I didn't have to have an extra person to help me carry the mattress up the stairs. But the saying is, three moves are as good as a fire. And it's true. If I think of all of the books that I used to own, but don't anymore because I had to move, because I packed them all in bags and took them to the used bookstore, or I packed them all in bags and donated them to Goodwill, or wherever I put them, whatever I did with them, I don't own them anymore. Some of those books I wish I had, but I didn't want to move them. I didn't want to keep track of them. I didn't want to inventory and store them. I didn't have room in my house for them. And as long as we're having to deal with that issue of storage and moving, digital will win. But I think it goes beyond that, and I've talked about that on the podcast before. Actually, I think I made a rather caustic comment. One of the guy who was leading the presentation said, but I love the feel of the book. I love the tactile sensation of my fingers on the page, of the impressions on the surface, of the smell. And my comment to him was, buy a blank book every once in a while, flip it open, riffle the pages, and get a good sniff, so then go back to reading on your e-reader. Because you'll be able to buy a lot more books on your e-reader than you can if you buy them in paper. And I'm really convinced that there's a major market disconnect at the publishing house because publishers believe that their product is books, while writers believe that their product is stories, and readers believe that the market is for stories. Yeah, there's a lot of people who say, oh, you'll have to pry the pages out of my cold dead fingers. It's like, no, not really. I'm perfectly willing for you to continue to have your books and to pay the top dollar for them as long as you like. Please do. I encourage you to do so because that's part of reading. I'm not going to say to somebody, you can't do that. The other side of it is, I'm not going to have to because eventually there's going to come a time when, for economic reasons, either the cost of the paperback books are going to be so expensive, or the economy is going to be such that they're not going to be able to afford to buy the books in paper. Paper will be a luxury. Paper books, books printed on paper, will be mementos. They'll be souvenirs. They will be artifacts that have meaning beyond the page, beyond the story that's contained within the covers. It will have meaning beyond what we think of now as a book. I know I have a Naomi Novik that's signed. It's a paperback. I'm sure she thought I was strange because I brought her a paperback book to sign. But paperbacks are what I read. Paperbacks is how I identify with authors. Paperbacks is, you know, particularly mass market paperbacks. This is a connection to my youth, if nothing else. So there's some interesting ideas there about why that book matters to me. It may be one of the last mass market paperbacks I bought, now that I think about it. I'm trying to think of if I bought anything since then. I think I bought a copy of Pattern Recognition by William Gibson. But I don't buy books. I buy ebooks. And quite frequently, quite honestly, I buy on Kindle. Why? Because of the big evil monolith? No, it's because they make buying easy. Because they make it easy for me to find things that I want to at least sample, and by sampling, read. There's an interesting study out that was published last week, a couple weeks ago now, about discoverability and how people discover books through ads. I look at that number and I think, really? Really? It's a large number. It's like 29-30% are influenced by ads. And I have to look at that and say, really? I know it's dangerous to extrapolate one's own experience onto a survey. That just because I don't do it doesn't mean other people don't do it. But I wonder, where do you see these ads? Where do these ads show up? What ads are they seeing? And what kind of specialized market is it that has advertising for books? Now, I'm in a lot of places where they're advertising, online in particular, but I never see them. And the history of online ads is that, for the most part, they're ignored. In my case, in many cases, they're blocked by the browser. The version of Chrome that I use locks out most of that kind of spam, and I don't ever see it. I might see a blank spot on the page, but I don't see the ad. So it's interesting that that many people would do it. So Monday, I went to school relatively early, about 8:20 in the morning, and met with the creative writing teachers at Greeley Central High. Fascinating classes. A lot of kids who really could care less, in spite of the fact that this is the art magnet school. A lot of kids who were sitting in the back of the class and being low profile, but would still twitch every once in a while, like perhaps they wanted to ask a question but didn't quite dare. So I thought that was rather interesting. There were several people who asked quite pointed questions that I was very grateful for, that they would be thinking that deeply. And one of the questions was, how can you, because I was talking about Ravenwood, and they said, well, if you write what you know, how do you write women? We had a good conversation about that, because it's really one of the big fundamental questions that writers have. So the most common advice is write what you know. And quite honestly, I don't know very much. But I can offer opinion. And as I told the young woman who asked me, you know, I don't know women, but I do know people. Not great, but some. And I think, and I could be wrong, but that I think women are first people. And if we talk about them as people, as irrespective of reproduction, people who have the same kinds of hopes and dreams and wishes, the same kinds of goals, who face many of the same obstacles of people of the other, then I've got a pretty rich tapestry to start from. And while I can't really understand what it's like, I can at least imagine, because I've got a pretty good imagination. So while I've never been on board an interstellar spaceship, I've never ridden in a solar clipper, I've never been to outer space, I've never been higher than a commercial airliner, I have been on a mess deck. And while I wasn't a cook on the mess deck, I remember what being on the mess deck smelled like. I worked in kitchens when I was a kid, so I know what food service is like. It's not what you think. No, I never worked at McDonald's, but I washed dishes. I know how it works. I know what you go through. And really, I think the best science fiction is about people. So that seemed to satisfy her very, to the most part. I'm not sure she really bought it, but I'm not sure they bought anything. And I took that as a good sign, because they were really quite skeptical of the whole thing. A couple classes, I actually showed them what a manuscript looked like. I had the reading script from FullShare with me, and I held it up and riffled through it. The teacher was particularly interested in what my writing process was. Several people, in fact, asked me, how do I write? And I explained the difference between a pantser and a plotter, and how I'm a binge writer. So I'm really a bad example of how to be a writer, because I go for months without writing anything, and then I suddenly binge out. I have, by the way, written 1,100 words so far today. I got those in before 7 o'clock. I'm hoping to get another 2,000-4,000 out today. I don't know if that's going to happen or not. I'm getting the walk out of the way early, relatively early. I got caught this morning by taxi duty, and then catching up with correspondence. So it was quite late for me to get out from the house. But my wife is home today. She's sick. And I wanted to get the walk in before the snowstorm hit. We've got a winter storm warning posted for this region. My phone keeps sending me messages about it. It's almost 40 degrees. I have a hard time believing it, but I do know that the temperature can drop by 10 degrees in a half an hour here if you're not paying attention. So I figured I may as well get the walk in, get the talk in, see if I can get back in the swing of things here after my illness. I did sleep almost nonstop for 48 hours after I got done with the class. I went home on Monday night, and managed to get some dinner. Managed to deal with children and taxi duty in the evening, but then collapsed very shortly thereafter. and pretty much stayed in bed. Well, Tuesday morning, I slept until the alarm, which almost never happens, and then slept for half the day, and went to bed at 7 o'clock on Tuesday night, and slept through until almost the alarm. It was 5:30 on Wednesday morning. That was yesterday. And even managed to sleep for part of the day yesterday in between wife and phone calls and everything. So I did an awful lot of sleeping, and I don't really know why, because I got good night's sleep while I was actually at the con. A lot of times you go to the con, you stay up late, you drink too much, you eat too much, you get up early, you're going all the time. And I didn't really do that. The con itself, while it went until 1 in the morning, I was back in my room and in bed by 10. Most of the stuff that happened in the evening wasn't stuff I was really all too interested in. So I called it and went to bed. I slept fairly well while I was there, so that wasn't a factor. My body needed rest in order to recover, I guess, so it claimed it. And quite frankly, it brooked no interference, because even when I tried to stay up, or I tried to sit up, I found myself falling asleep in my chair. So I went to bed and figured, listen to your body. It says it needs to sleep. Believe it. And apparently I did. Because today I got up and I don't feel too bad. I still have a little twist in the gut, but it's not serious. I have an appetite back, which is a mixed blessing. While I was sick, I didn't have a really big appetite. I didn't feel like eating anything that I thought of. It sounded completely unappetizing. And so I didn't eat a whole lot. This morning I was ready for breakfast. So I'm back. I'm walking. And we're walking. And talking. I did do a podcast for my class today. It was more of an apology than a real podcast. They're doing a really good job of reading Postman. Some of them are still reading him and taking him for on face value. More of them are beginning to question what it is that he's saying. I think that's a good sign. In part, I get the usual number of, well, you know, kids today are just too lazy. They just want to sit on the couch and watch, play video games and stuff. It's like, I made a comment this morning on one blog about that's in my day. That's what my parents used to say about me, that I was lazy. I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to lay around and read science fiction books. Yeah, they'd have to pry me out of my room to make me go outside. And I would. I'd go outside. I'd take a paperback with me and go outside and read a book, which somehow seemed to satisfy them to a certain extent, but always made them wonder, you know, why isn't he doing something? Why isn't he riding his bike? Why isn't he weeding the garden? Well, weeding the garden was pretty easy. Why wasn't he weeding the garden? We had an extensive garden growing up. And I mean, extensive. It was about an acre worth of garden. Now, I didn't know that at the time, because I had no idea how much land we really had. I mean, I knew the number, but it was like, it's kind of hard to get your head around 350 acres of land. It's like, how big is that? It's big enough that if I set out and started walking from my house straight back into the woods, I could walk for the better part of 45 minutes to an hour through the woods without stepping off land that we owned. It was big enough that the Forestry Service used us as a tree farm, and it was a lot of woods. It was a lot of trees. was a lot of land, but 1 acre of it right beside the house was garden. And a big part of it was potatoes. Another part was corn. There was a section that was set aside for vined crops like cucumbers and squash. We had way too many zucchinis in the summer. But we also had Blue Hubbard, which wintered well in the cellar. So we had a lot of stuff that we stored through the winter that we ate all winter long. Potatoes were the staple, but corn, it got flash boiled, cut off the cob and frozen. A lot of green beans, a lot of peas, carrots, cabbages. A lot of stuff. We did a lot of pickles with cucumbers. My mother had several different recipes for cucumber pickles. Sweet elephant ears, bread and butter pickles with small bits of green tomato and cucumber and onion, all kinds of stuff. I even had beet pickles. I hated beets. Still hate beets. I can't stand beets. Boiled beets. But pickled beets. Pickle beets are kind of cool. I like pickle beets. They stain like a son of a gun, though. You have to be careful not to lose a pickle beet off your plate and onto the table, because it would stain the tabletop. And God help you if you got it on a linoleum counter. Yeah, no kidding. So, you know, growing up, weeding the garden was one of my chores. I hated it because it was hot, and it was dirty, and it was boring, and I really didn't understand what I was doing. So occasionally you go through a line of carrots and find that I pulled all the carrots and left all the weeds, particularly when they were small, because it's really kind of hard to tell the difference if you don't really know any better. And to say that I knew any better, that would be a gross understatement. Later, when crops got big enough and I could do things like hoe the corn, that wasn't quite so bad. You go in with the hoe and kind of cut the weeds down as they grow up. The roots don't come out, so you have to go through again in a few days and cut them off again, again, and again. Eventually they give up. Particularly when the corn gets big enough to start providing some shade. Potatoes in their hills were another challenge. I always had potato bugs on them. Yuck. So I wasn't really big on gardening. I wasn't a gardener. I didn't think I was going to amount to much because I was such a lazy kid. I didn't want to do anything but read books until at one point I liked playing with wires and computers and stuff. So I would spend hours making really pointless things out of cardboard boxes and Christmas tree lights and railroad train power supplies. It was pretty engaging for me, but on the scale of it, on the surface of it, on the reality of it, it was kind of silly. It was kind of pointless. Although I learned a lot. I can't really say what I learned. Those early experiments really helped me solidify a lot of what I think about machines and computers and technology, even though I can't really explain what it might have been. But reading the greats, reading Stanislaw Lem, reading Isaac Asimov, reading H. Beam Piper, Charles P. Hogan, Arthur C. Clarke, these are guys with some big ideas, with some interesting notions. And there are hundreds more that I have no idea who they were, because I went through what felt like dozens and dozens of ace doubles. And I have no idea who wrote those books. Well, that's interesting. I just made the turn across the end of the park apparently they've been in here with a backhoe. There was a catch basin here where one of the culverts emptied out. It's been flattened and drained, which is good because in the summer, otherwise it would have been mosquito heaven. Let's hope it's been fixed enough now that the water will actually drain off and into the field. So yeah, I read a lot, but I was, to the outside, lazy. I wasn't doing anything, but I had a rich inner world. I had a world that was more than just the stories themselves, although I would have been hard-pressed to say so at the time. And I've played games that are so engaging that time disappears, that you spend 5 hours without even realizing you haven't moved. And those worlds are engaging in another way. And are they just being lazy? Does that engagement actually tell us something? Does it teach us something? I don't know. I've spent a lot of time, and a lot of people would say wasted a lot of time, playing these games. But somehow I can't quite bring myself to say that that time has been wasted. I mean, yeah, other stuff doesn't get done. But has that time been wasted? And I don't know. I don't have a really good answer to that because I have to look back at my youth when a lot of what I did appeared to be wasting time. When in fact what I was doing was learning, exploring, trying out ideas, trying out thoughts that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to have. Seeing what kinds of notions stuck in my head and which ones went away. The time when I found a really good bug-eyed monster story in some magazine and I had to go to school and read something. I wanted to read the whole story because just reading the first 2 pages didn't cut it and it wasn't complete. And I kept asking for more time to read and more time to read till finally the whole class had been taken up and everybody else who's supposed to read didn't get a chance to. And I never finished the story. I didn't get a very good grade. But I had a lot of fun and I learned something. It wasn't necessarily what the teacher wanted, which was interesting. Anyway, I've made the loop. I'm back at the back gate. And tomorrow's another day. Perhaps I'll talk to you then.